Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, Nigeria, 1993. A pivotal election is cancelled, denying the tycoon and philanthropist Moshood Abiola the presidency. The man who did it, Ibrahim Babangida, says he is sorry. How does this help? Chief Abiola's son, Jamiu, responds.
We should focus on the impact that junta should have, which is no more ethnicity, no more tribalism, no more guilt, no more corruption. And with the spirit of June 12th and the grace of God, we will achieve what we need to achieve.
What's driving the lack of affordable housing in Kinshasa, one of the fastest growing megacities in Africa? And a young farmer from Botswana explains how his business will change with the lifting of a ban on South African vegetable imports.
I mean, during the ban, you know, a lot of farmers are actually growing, upscaling their projects. But in terms of the future with this ban, it's definitely to diversify. I'm looking to some of the value adds in the fresh produce sector, processing of condiments and frozen vegetables.
It's Monday, the 24th of February. First, we go to Nigeria.
Credible, free and fair elections were held on June 12, 1993. However, the tragic irony of history remains that the administration that devised a near-perfect electoral system and conducted those near-perfect elections could not complete the process. That accident of history is most regrettable. The nation is entitled to expect my impression of regret.
That was retired General Ibrahim Babangida, known as IBB, expressing remorse for cancelling the June 1993 presidential election. It's an election widely regarded as having been the most free and most credible in the history of Nigeria. And that cancellation is said to have changed the course of Nigerian politics for the worse. So who was Ibrahim Babangida? He was a Nigerian military dictator who in 1985 orchestrated a coup against his arch rival Muhammadu Buhari, who later became president as well. Under constant pressure to transition the country to civilian rule, General Babangida had promised a democratic handover through elections held on the 12th of June 1993. That process was stopped in its tracks before the final result could be announced. Outraged Nigerians protested. The country was in turmoil. For nearly 32 years, the reasons behind the annulment have remained shrouded in controversy. Now, in his autobiography, A Journey in Service, the 83-year-old retired General Babangida has, for the first time, publicly admitted that Moshood Abiola won those elections. The fallout from the annulment was severe. Babangida was forced to step down in August 1993. The man who is said to have won, the tycoon and philanthropist Moshood Abiola, declared himself president and was arrested. He died in jail a few years later and his wife, Kudirat, was assassinated. The BBC's Chris Ewoko spoke to the son of Moshood Abiola, Jamiu, and asked him if these comments from Ibrahim Babangida are too little, too late.
No, it's not coming too little, too late, because God's time is the best time. We should focus on the impact that junta should have, which is no more ethnicity, no more tribalism, no more guilt, no more corruption. We want to make the country great. And with the spirit of June 12th, by the grace of God, we will achieve what we need to achieve.
So what does this all mean for Nigeria today? A country not at all at ease due to a cost of living crisis, a security crisis in the north, and ever louder talk of separatist states in the southeast. I spoke to Professor Bola Akinterinwa, a diplomat and scholar. He's also Professor Emeritus at Achievers University. How significant was this annulment way back in 1993?
It was very significant, and it is still very significant. It was in the political history of Nigeria the first time we will have the freest, the fairest election in Nigeria. Why? Because the chairman of the National Independent and Electoral Commission, Professor Humphrey Nwosu, who is now late, adopted an unprecedented method of election. He adopted what was called and known as Option A4. Option A4 was a method that required voters to queue behind their candidate. In the physical absence of the candidate, the photograph of the candidate along with the political party represented were posted so people could see who he or she is voting for. So in this case, you queue up. When it comes to counting, the number of people that queued, the first person will say one, the next person will count two, then three, four. The last person, if it is 50, that means 50 people have voted for that particular candidate. At the same time, it is recorded. Everybody knows who has won on the spot, and it is recorded. So there was no need, for instance, going to any local government office to go and be counting. And all night, there was no room for rigging. It was so straightforward.
So basically what he did was he made the system transparent. Tell us about those two personalities, IBB, Ibrahim Babangida, and Chief Moshood Abiola first.
Babangida was then the military head of state of Nigeria. MKO Abiola was a contending presidential candidate, and he was contesting against Tofa. You know, Babangida introduced a sort of two-party system, and he was saying that people should move a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. And you have MKO Abiola leading Tofa.
And Mr. Abiola was also a very rich man in Nigeria, right?
Yes, of course. He was fantastically rich and not fantastically, you know, corrupt, as we now have in the lexicon in Nigeria's political history. He was rich. You know, he's a very good entrepreneur, and he was very altruistic. He has a very good personality at the level of the people and at the level of the military as well.
I know that IBB, as he was also known, or Maradona was his other name in Nigeria. Why did Nigerians call him that? What does it tell us about how they perceived him?
The word Maradona, I think it was either David Mack or one politician described him, gave him as a nickname. Maradona is a footballer, renowned world player. And because he's known to be a dribbler, he dribbles well on the field. So people perceived Babangida as a dribbler. He was dribbling people. Even he had another nickname apart from Maradona. He's described as evil genius.
So his tactics, they were referring to the fact that he could play the Nigerian political system and win.
Yes, so right. He's a good tactician. He's able to dribble people here and there.
So what would you say was the long-term effect of that decision to annul the elections of June the 12th on Nigerian politics, and how does it play out today?
It divided the polity sharply. The pro-democracy groups were bent on their struggle for democracy, and the military, under Sani Abacha in particular, were not readily prepared to accept that. Babangida made it clear that if MKO Abiola had been allowed to be sworn in as president of Nigeria, that there would be insecurity in the country, that they do not like him, the military did not like MKO Abiola, and that even if he had been allowed to come in, he wouldn't stay for long there, he would have been killed. So meaning that whether he was sworn in or not, MKO Abiola was a problem to the military. So this was the issue. And as of today, the pattern of voting in Nigeria, even if we claim to have democracy in place, this has led to agitations at the level of the Southwest, the Yoruba people, and the Southeast, the Igbo people. there are agitations for separation. You know, they want to be carved out of Nigeria. Why? Simply because the political leadership in Nigeria has been seen to be very dishonest. While the government is talking about indissolubility of Nigeria, indivisibility of Nigeria, that's on paper, as provided in the 1999 constitution as amended. But as it is today, people do not believe in the constitution. So people are divided. And it's largely as a result of the way people perceived the 1993 election.
So now that Mr. Babangida has made this admission that Chief Abiola actually won that election, what are the implications of that? Could there be legal consequences for his actions?
One can say the likelihood of any legal report, anybody raising issue, may not arise. On the other side, yes, legal cases can come up, because now people can say legitimately that the man won it, MK Abiola won it, but he was denied. Because the Yoruba people, the people in Southwest, basically the Yoruba people, were so aggrieved, so annoyed about that, and now looking at it to say, why will MK Abiola be prevented when he actually won? And now that it has now been revealed that he actually won, what do you expect the Yoruba to do?
Do you think that young people in Nigeria care about this at all? Or do they feel that it's something in the past and they need to deal with the fallout, basically?
Well, I will look at it from two perspectives. One, that they do not care. Reason is that they were not aware of the history and they are not aware of the historiography of the matter. So when you don't have an idea of what has happened, you cannot be as much concerned as it should be. But the issue now is that when we now talk about the youth in the future, they will be much concerned. They will want to know what is happening. People will want to read Babangida's memoirs now. And people are increasingly asking for copies. So I want to believe that the youth will be more concerned in the foreseeable future. And they are most likely to have learned how to go about their own future.
That was Professor Bola Akinterinwa, diplomat and scholar, and also Professor Emeritus at Achievers University. Did you know that the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo is on track to become Africa's largest megacity by 2030, with a population that is likely to exceed 17 million people? Kinshasa is on track to outstrip Lagos and Cairo, two of the other African urban dynamos on the list of 15 biggest cities in the world. Unfortunately, one of the main effects of this rapid urbanization is a lack of affordable housing and proper services like water and sanitation, electricity, healthcare, schools. So most of the residents in Kinshasa live in informal settlements. And a new report by the Center of International Cooperation at New York University and the International Institute for Environment and Development shows that the housing crisis in Kinshasa is worsening. The war in the East is not helping as people flee from there to find safety in the capital. Low incomes, high prices, and a lack of supply adds to the problem. Thomas Pumbu Ngudia is looking for housing in Limete, a district in Kinshasa.
No, Massina, the issue is traffic jam. So for me to leave Massina for the city center or to Limete here, it's quite challenging. And sometimes it even affects my business.
Is Limete a more expensive area than Massina?
Yes, Limete is more expensive area than Massina.
So give me an idea of house prices. To rent a house in Limete, how much would it be in dollar terms, if you don't mind? And how does that relate to rent in other parts of Kinshasa and Massina, where you are now?
In Massina, like a two-room house, the rent is $60. And speaking of the security deposits, most of the time it's free or months. But in Limete, is around $100. And the issue is, speaking of the security deposit, so the vast majority of landlords, they only require a 10-month security deposit. So that's a bit so challenging.
So why is it difficult to get a house in Limete? Is it because everybody wants to live there and there are few areas that offer you all those benefits?
No, for me, the only one area that I've targeted is Limete. And what is challenging to me is only like the security deposit that is required. So normally, based on the law that we have here, normally the security deposit for a residential tenancy is 3 months. But in Limete here, some landlords don't comply with that measure. And imagine if I have to find a house of $100 per month, and if I have to pay like a 10-month security deposit, it's around $1,000. It's quite expensive. That's what is challenging for me.
Paula Seville Nunez is a housing justice researcher at the International Institute for Environment and Development. And she's been telling me some of the challenges people like Thomas Ngudia is up against.
So when you say that only 6 out of 1,000 people can afford the cheapest housing, what is the cheapest housing? What does it cost a month for rent in dollars?
This would be to purchase a housing unit. And so this is $40,000 is what is calculated by the Center for Affordable Housing Finance in Africa.
And what would you get for that?
So that would be just a very basic 2-bedroom house in the DRC.
What about rented accommodation? Because that's what most people can afford. Barely.
Yes. People have very low incomes in Kinshasa, the majority, right? And so in informal settlements, it kind of varies. But if we were looking for a formal apartment that has what we call security of tenure, this would be, if you pick the example of Cité Kinoasis. The Cité Kinoasis is one of housing project that actually you can find on some of the websites of the government promoting it as a social housing, even though the term might vary from what we might think of in the UK, for example. So an average worker with a monthly salary of $26 would have to save their entire monthly salary every month for approximately 6 years to afford 1 month's rent in one of these apartments. So this is the kind of housing that is being built, that is being promoted as a solution to the housing crisis. You can see that there's a massive disparity between what is being proposed and what is actually accessible to people.
What's caused the crisis?
There are many reasons for it, and some of the causes are common and others are more specific to Congo. Of course, one of them is just low incomes. The average wage, as I was saying, was very, very low. A teacher earns less than $500 per month. The World Bank estimates that almost 75% of the population in Congo earn less than $2 a day. So that's, of course, very low income. But it's not just about their income. It's also the lack of available mechanisms to purchase a home. 12% of adults in Congo have a bank account. It's very low. And there are very few financing mechanisms to purchase a mortgage, to access financing, to use collateral, for example, because the majority of people work in the informal sector. And they don't have kind of a way of demonstrating their income, which is quite volatile.
But housing is an international right. Congo is perpetually at war with hundreds of thousands of people leaving the areas where they live that are affected by war and coming into the city.
In fact, one of the challenges of urbanization, as we're seeing today in many cities in Africa and also in some parts of Asia, is that a lot of the reason why cities are growing is not necessarily because of the economic opportunities that they offer, but also because a lot of people are leaving the places where they originally lived because, again, lack of economic opportunity and also conflict, climate disasters, the inability to live safely in the places where they are. So you have a lot of people coming into cities that usually don't have the infrastructure or the economic opportunity to offer that prosperity that people come looking for in the city. So it's very much a problem.
So these are desperate people coming into the city. You told us a little bit about what the government was doing in terms of offering very expensive social housing. But what about the local authorities?
The way that local authorities can respond or not vary a lot by country. And usually housing is, it's a complicated one because a lot of the solutions for housing can come from local governments, but they usually don't have the budget necessary. They don't have the people, the capacity to do so. For example, back in 2015, there were some plans that were put out to address some of these issues. And the budget was around $4.7 billion for these plans. None of it has been financed yet. And similarly, this is not at the local level, but at the national level, you have the establishment of the National Fund for Habitat, the FONAB, which is one of the institutions that the government is putting forward to help address the crisis. And They were established in 2018. They only became operational in 2023. And they're yet to receive the first budgetary allocation. So there's obviously a big capacity issue as well.
And the impact of people living in informal settlements, 75% of the population, according to your report, what kinds of lives do those people live?
Living in informal settlements is a response to the lack of delivery of housing. And so it's very challenging to talk about informal settlements because usually the narrative is around parasitic cities, chaotic cities that can sometimes lead to going against the people that live there. But first and foremost, it has to be very clear that these people are providing housing solutions for themselves, and it's very much a need. But of course, these informal settlements often don't have the quality of living conditions and access to services that is needed. These people also live in a constant state of insecurity in the sense that they don't own the housing, they don't own the land, and they're usually left in this vicious cycle of being evicted, displaced, having to build housing again. But upgrading informal settlements and working to improve informal settlements has massive benefits to offer. There was a study by my institute, the International Institute for Environment and Development, that demonstrated that improving access in informal settlements can prevent more than 730,000 preventable deaths annually. So you would be avoiding a number of deaths that is higher than eradicating malaria globally. This is the promise of working with the communities that live in informal settlements and improving their living conditions. So it's not just to benefit them, it could have a society-wide impact.
Paola Seville Nunez from the International Institute for Environment and Development. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's meet a young farmer from Botswana now. Tumelo Mapila and his wife started farming in 2021 during the COVID pandemic. The government at the time had banned vegetables from South Africa next door, saying it wanted to encourage local production and reduce Botswana's reliance on South African products. People like Tumelo benefited from that policy. But that ban is now being lifted in two phases. The first happened late last year and allowed the resumption of imports like pumpkin, sweet potatoes, mushrooms and aubergines. The next phase kicks in April. The lifting of the ban happened under President Duma Boko, who had displaced the founding political party in seismic elections late last year. A new President Duma Boko says the two-phase lifting of the ban is to make vegetables more affordable for consumers who have been complaining that the locally produced vegetables were not up to scratch in terms of quality, availability and pricing. But how will the lifting of the ban affect young farmers like Tumelo? You started in 2021. What inspired you to do that?
Yeah, essentially 2021 was just after COVID. So here in Botswana, we had the whole issue of lockdowns and not being able to get access to what we are always used to getting off the shelves, vegetables, fruits and the likes. And during the lockdowns, my wife and I realized that this luxury of walking to a shop and getting whatever you want is not a guarantee anymore. So we decided that we'll grow food for ourselves and we'll sell the excess. And then over time, we realized that we're growing way too much. And that's when we started to look at it as a commercial venture and we'll just eat or you consume what's left over.
So how has it been going?
Lots of ups, lots of downs. It's been quite a bit of a challenge because we've never farmed before. So when we started, it was really an experiment to see if we have the gut and the grit for it. First yield was quite motivating and successful, for lack of a better word. And we've had quite a bit of challenges, not only selling or going to market, because we had to register with all the stores that we were supplying, you know, all the major chain stores that do buy from farmers, which isn't a straightforward process. Some of the stores took us over a year to register with them. But now we're registered with nearly all the stores in the country. And it's still a challenge in the sense that they only buy when they want. So we always find selling a lot of our produce can be a bit tricky, especially when there's a flood in the market.
Did you decide to farm or to upscale your farming in line with the 2021 ban by the government on South African vegetables and farming produce?
No. So that was a great development at the time. We had already sort of worked out our logistics and worked out how we're going to get into the market. So that ban really came at a time when we were starting to get a good feel of the market and good feel for prices.
Did it help?
We felt Yeah, it did help quite a bit, especially where now a lot of the stores were now calling us to find out what produce we have, when we can supply. Sometimes, obviously, we wouldn't have some of the crops, but, you know, we mainly focus on what we call high-value crops.
And what are those?
So the likes of your red cabbages, bell peppers, jalapenos. We've done cherry tomatoes at one point. We just finished the harvest of baby marrows and patty pans, sort of how the high-value crops, yeah.
So you don't do the basic spinach and cabbage and onions and potatoes that ordinary people eat. You're aiming further up the value chain.
Yeah, absolutely. Also of the scale that we're operating at. Further up the scale makes a lot of sense for us. Logistically, it's not as capital intensive, but there is a market for it. So that's sort of our strategy.
How many people work on your farm?
During peak season, we have about four. But during low seasons, or like when we're preparing for the next season, we maintain a team of about two.
Is that you and your wife and two other people?
Yes, it is.
I mean, sounds like hard work.
It is a lot of hard work. Mind you, my wife and I have day jobs as well. So you can imagine what that looks like.
Goodness.
On a day-to-day basis.
Did you get any support from government during the time that the ban was there? And when you started up, did they give you any support, whether financial or in terms of know-how?
There was certain programs that the government had put in place, but we weren't able to successfully receive, for instance, some of the grants that they had in place. And some of the, there was the grants for Temolotlotlo, and they also had like other grants where you could buy certain equipment. Yeah, we weren't able to successfully get that, even though I know of other farmers that were able to secure some of those grants and finance for equipment.
Do you know why you weren't able to get the grants?
No, I don't know why. We've gone through the whole process, applied, and I don't know if it's turnaround time or I don't know yet. I'm still trying to figure out where we are with that.
People say that the product and the produce that was locally produced wasn't of the same quality that they were getting from South Africa before the ban. Do you agree with that? Do you think that it's a fair comment for them to make?
As a farmer, knowing the process and what it takes to produce good produce, I wouldn't agree to that. One of our big value adds, especially at Masawaruna, which is essentially our farming venture, is to ensure that we do supply the best. And that really begins at the process of planning when you're looking at what you're going to plant. So getting the right premium seeds, we always do that. Maintaining your plants during production is a very key thing. But I think what happens on the shelves, which is what a consumer would see, is there are some stores that do farm for themselves as well, and they do put their own produce on the shelf. And what I've found, at least from a little bit of research and talking to other farmers, is that they don't really care about the quality of produce that they put on the shelf. And that comes across as Botswana farmers not being able to produce the same quality. So they're just really basically selling fresh produce at almost zero cost, considering that they're farming the same produce that farmers are. And they're just putting whatever comes off their farm straight onto their shelves. So from a consumer's point of view, that's an aspect that they wouldn't fully understand. But when it comes to farmers, for instance, some stores would only buy certain amounts from some farmers, but you'd see that they're pushing their own produce onto the shelves.
How do you think the lifting of the ban now will affect your business?
It's going to affect us quite significantly. Look at also some of the crops that we focus on. We are going to essentially be competing at whatever produce actually makes it across the border. Not only that, a lot of the South African farmers really do produce at huge scales. But I think the biggest sort of, well, I haven't started to experience it, but the biggest challenge that I know we'd face is having to compete the pricing that the shops are getting in South Africa. When we started, that was essentially the biggest thing. We used to supply chili, but the baseline was, why should I buy chili from you at, you know, 15 kula per kg while I'm getting it at 15 rands or 10 rands per kg across the border? So that's going to be a big challenge. Well, our approach to this is essentially to look at the value adds from the fresh produce, looking at your frozen alternatives, condiments and processing of a certain produce.
Would you rather the ban wasn't lifted?
I'm not against lifting of the ban. I think the approach of how it was lifted could have really had some baseline data. I felt not many farmers were consulted. I mean, for myself, I don't even know if any farmers were consulted. You know, it's really an interesting time because we have a new administration. You know, we're very optimistic about the future that they have for us. But as a farmer, you know, it was a little bit unsettling to have received that because I first saw it in a WhatsApp message that was shared on one of our groups. So it was like, whoa, is this actually happening? So it's a very interesting place that we are. I'm very optimistic about the new administration. But in terms of consultation, in terms of how that decision was come about, I can't say very much about it.
You don't sound happy, though, because I see from the list of vegetables that will be back on the import list is something mm-hmm. that you do farm, patty pans.
Yeah.
That's immediately. Mm-hmm. And then phase two, which starts in April, will lift the ban on sweet peppers, which is something that you also farm. So at least two of your products are going to be affected. You can't be happy
very
about
much
that. So you can't be happy about that. But do you think that it's just consultation? And if they did consult and still went ahead with the ban, it wouldn't make a difference to you, would it? Or would you diversify?
Yeah, it would have made a big difference because in the consultation, you would have understood the rationale behind it. I mean, during the ban, we got a lot of information as to how the import bill was reduced and, you know, a lot of farmers are actually growing, upscaling their projects. But in terms of the future with this ban, it's definitely to diversify. I've also just highlighted that I'm looking to some of the value adds in the fresh produce sector, processing of condiments and frozen vegetables, is something I'm looking into.
Thank you very much. And pula, ne? Dinala.
Pula.
Pula.
Kato pula. Yeah, indeed. And then we say aine, like let it rain.
Aine, let it rain. All right, then. Bye-bye.
All right, cheers. Thanks.
That's Tumelo Mapila, a young farmer from Botswana. Focus on Africa was produced by Sunita Nahar and Amy Leibovitz here in London. Blessing Aderogba was in Lagos. Paul Bajibinga was the senior producer in charge, and Jack Graysmark, our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. The latest edition of our sister pod, Africa Daily, explores how the hike in data and mobile phone call prices has affected Nigerians. Find it where you find your other podcasts. I'm Audrey Brown. And we'll talk again next time.